It's a bit hard to hear, but this is an elder singing a Cree rendition of O Canada over the intercom at Pelican Falls, a First Nations high school in Northern Ontario. When I recorded her singing, I didn't think much of it at the time, just that it was pretty. When I re-listened on my own, however, the true significance of it struck me. Here was an elder who had possibly attended residential school or known someone who had witnessed generations afflicted by trauma from having their culture stripped from them, who had witnessed the Canadian government finally confront its dark history with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools.
And yet, despite all this, she's singing the national anthem of a country that did nothing but fail her, again and again and again. But this place, this school she represents, is not really about looking back over one's shoulder at the past. This school was built by Indigenous people for Indigenous people. It's to give the youth a fighting chance in a system designed to bring them down. This is Pelican Falls. Bonjour. Hello. My name is Tashina Buzwa. I'm Oji Cree of North Spirit Lake First Nation on Treaty 5 territory in Northern Ontario. In this series, I'm going to talk about two high schools, Dennis Franklin Cromartie High School in Thunder Bay and Pelican Falls First Nations High School in Sulicout, Ontario. These aren't your average schools. In order to attend, you must leave your family, community, and home behind. You must travel hundreds of kilometers south in a tiny prop plane to a new school and your new life. For some kids, it's their first time leaving the reserve. You can be as young as 13 when you leave home to begin grade 9. And for these kids, it's their only option to attend a physical high school. There are typically no options on reserve. It's a challenging experience for these teens. It's scary, it's exciting, it's a long way from home. Ultimately, I wanted to take a look at these schools to see how they function as Indigenous education models. Are they successful in a post-residential school era Canada? What are the challenges? What are the successes? What does it mean to receive a First Nations-based education? Why isn't there an option for them to stay home with their communities and families, as any child should be able to? These are some of the questions I intend on answering in this mini-series. Also, what's my place in all this? I grew up in Sulicout. My mother taught at Pelican for 20 years, and I'm Indigenous myself, but is that alone enough to warrant my welcome here? I was born in Thunder Bay, and I visited it often throughout my youth, but does that instantly give me the right to set up camp at Dennis Franklin and ask people for their stories and their energy and their time? I tried to be aware of these admittedly complicated questions while I was in both places gathering interviews. Anyway, let's take a closer look at Pelican Falls. Here, you not only attend the school, but you also live on its grounds. There's a cluster of boarding houses scattered near the main school building, and you'll live in one of these houses with around 12 other students, plus a house counselor. An average weekday looks pretty much how you'd expect it to.
Usually, I wake up and I just get ready for school. And then the house counselor, they have like breakfast ready downstairs. So then we get ready, we go eat, then we brush our teeth, then we go to school. Mm-hmm. And like during school, it's like a normal day. You're just walking around, seeing friends, mm-hmm. going to class.
For the students who go to Pelican, there's a lot of mixed feelings about the place.
Hard and lonely. They try to keep the students busy instead of everyone just doing nothing and like being all bored. Mm. I like how they try to get everyone involved.
Probably the sports and the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty comfortable with the people here.
Do you like the staff?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love the staff here. Oh, awesome. They're pretty nice.
Yeah. You feel that they kind of go the extra mile for you guys?
Yeah. Basically without school trips.
Yeah. They take sports. You guys out of the body.
Yeah.
When I first came to Pelican, it was like pretty exciting at first. Then when I like got used to it, it kind of got ugly, but it's okay sometimes.
Why did it get ugly?
Because the people's vibes and like just other people, mm-hmm. like being mean, not knowing what they're saying, that it could hurt someone.
In all my interactions with the students at Pelican, it was honestly hard to differentiate between what could be perceived as teenage angst and the results of a deeper psychological impact brought on by being separated from their family and community. There's a lot to unpack here, but the ultimate feeling I walked away with was that quote-unquote normal teenage angst at a place like Pelican is never simply angst, but compounded and layered by the many other realities and burdens that these kids have to carry at such a young age. Simply put, I can imagine the particular loneliness felt by these kids, who for 8 months out of the year essentially don't see their parents. There's also a physical loneliness. Pelican is a 20-minute drive from the town of Sulakout, in a forested area near a lake. It's quiet out there. If you close your eyes, you could almost feel as if you were in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, a little bit. I feel isolated here because only on the weekends, I don't know, it's just when they have nothing to do all day.
Like not being able to like go out, do your favorite things, like go for like long walks or like go driving around or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't really do that. Mm-hmm. Like you're walking around with like a bunch of other people. You don't really know where to go.
It's very isolated there.
Mm. Yeah.
There's always some days where you just feel isolated, lonely, and especially for like new students that go there, like it's probably like their first time going out of the reserve at all, and to like have their first experience at like an isolated place 20 minutes out of Sulakout, like that's kind of crazy in a way, but like I enjoyed my time there. They made it enjoyable for me.
Not only can it be isolating for the students, but it's also hard on their parents and grandparents. This is Christine Kekagamik. Last year, she watched as her 14-year-old grandson got on a plane and left their home community of Kiwewin to go to school.
It was hard. And that day when he came out, I just stayed home from work, you know. I just slept all day, and then my daughter woke me up in the evening. She said, I think it's about time you get up. She knew what I was going through in my head. She knew that I was missing my grandson. It's like I knew he's alive and well. But still, that thought, being him alone out here, you know, it was hard.
What truly makes Pelican unique is the fact that it is ultimately an Indigenous school run by Indigenous leaders for the youth of 49 remote communities. This is Lynette Polinchenko, a teacher at Pelican Falls and someone I've known for years.
Very unique, yeah. Multiple things that are unique, right? So if you start on the grand scale,
We're funded by the federal government, opposed to a provincial board, meaning our organization that oversees us is Northern Anishinaabe Education Council, which is the board is made up of chiefs from the communities from which our students are from. So they make the decisions. And I think like the goal and vision behind Pelican Falls was that we Indigenous people would be educating their own youth, or that we would have a say in how this education goes down here. And with the history of residential schools and then even just like provincial curriculum not really including Indigenous perspective, I think it's awesome that we have a high school that focuses on that. We have youth from like a large land area that come to our school. So there's like a lot of communities represented within our high school here, which makes it unique. The students live on site in boarding homes or in houses all together. And it's the only option for students, many students who want to get their high school education, but they don't have a high school in their reserve.
At Pelican, they recognize the importance of educating Indigenous youth with both modern and traditional knowledge. Nathan Hunter is the vice principal. He's been here for 12 years and is the founder of the school's first traditional land-based course, which his students can take for credit.
We're setting the net. We were identifying trees and other useful plants. We utilized Lac-Seul First Nation as well to go on a multi-day moose hunting and waterfowl trip. We've harvested wild rice. So we really tried to make it as regional or local as possible. Mm. I think these programs are important to help our students regain or start to acknowledge again where our people come from in the region. It's been only within the last couple of generations that the time that people are spending on the land has really diminished. And to be able to support our young people's identities through practicing some of the things that our ancestors have done, to me is really important in helping to develop young people that are able to succeed in today's world. Mm-hmm. I like the idea, I didn't come up with the term, but it's popular now, where that's kind of this two worlds approach, where sometimes it's described as successful Aboriginal people today have kind of a foot in both worlds, where they are well-versed academically and able to, I'll say, succeed in the modern colonized world that we live in. But they also have a requirement or a need, I think, to have a good sense of understanding where Aboriginal people came from. Mm-hmm. And as much as possible, hang on to some of those skills and knowledge that helped our people be successful up until modern times.
The people here obviously care about these kids. Cultural competency is vital. Traditional knowledge is crucial. And it's been that way since the school opened in 1992. I was lucky enough to talk to some of the teachers that were there at the very beginning.
My name is Michael Bowes, and I am from Sulacoat, Ontario. So I was hired. I was actually working at WASA, Distance Education, at the time. I was in 1991. And I was hired by NNEC to work with the first principal of Pelican Falls.
My name's Desta Buzwa, and I am originally from Red Lake, Ontario. And I am a teacher by trade. When I was going to university and studying to become a teacher, I recall hearing about this pilot program that was going to begin in September 1992, known as Pelican Falls First Nations High School. This was exactly where I wanted to go, like in terms of if I could pick my ideal job, my ideal first teaching assignment, Pelican Falls would have definitely been my number one, two, and three.
I was hired in January of that year, and we spent, I guess, the following 8 months or so setting up the school. We purchased all of the portables that kind of made up the final building in the end, and we wrote all of the course outlines for what was going to be. At the beginning, it was a grade 9, 10 program at the school.
It was a very small school. We had roughly maybe about 148 or so students on site. We were in portables at that time. And there were four trailers put together that formed Pelican Falls First Nations High School, where you knew everyone in the school and everyone knew you, regardless if you taught them or not. You know, you when you were assigned hall duty, you essentially could look down one hall, because we only had one hall back then, and you could call any student by name to tell them, okay, you know, and tell them probably which teacher was waiting for them, because we only ever had six classes in session at one time.
Being a school set in nature, you're going to run into some unique situations. This is Wendy Espana. She used to teach science and math at Pelican.
One day we were in cooking class. We ran a baking, I guess it was baking. And one of the students we sent into the school to get something, and they came flying back in, and a bear had been walking down the hallway of the school when they went in, because the doors were wide open because it was summer and warm. And he came running back, screaming, saying there's a bear.
These are sort of things like urban high schools wouldn't really have to contend with on the daily, you know, nature. But at Pelican, we were surrounded by, you know, all of our relations, you know, and that it was really a beautiful learning space.
It really is in the middle of nature. Like when you look outside the windows, there is nature all around. Mm-hmm. The lake, the bush, it is mm-hmm. it is a really beautiful, beautiful spot.
As physically beautiful as it is at Pelican, it sits in the long shadow of a grim past, and it might surprise you when you hear it.
It also is situated on the former Pelican Falls Indian Residential School, and the students that are currently attending Pelican Falls are educated of the historical importance of that place, because their family members may have attended that Indian residential school, and now the First Nations within the Sulakaut district have wanted to reclaim that space.
If you live in Canada, you should hopefully know what a residential school is and what those schools mean to Indigenous people. Essentially, in the 1870s, the Canadian government decided that Native children needed to be assimilated into white society. Partnered with the church, government officials tore children from their families and forced them to attend the schools. The physical, emotional, and sexual abuse that occurred in these schools left the survivors deeply scarred, prone to addictive behavior and patterns of abuse in their own parenting. This set the scene for intergenerational trauma that is still affecting Indigenous people today.
It was difficult, right, for some parents to have their kids going to school there, and to come and visit at the site, right? And just having attended the residential school, right, at that site at some point, right? So, yeah.
Honestly, I can't imagine having gone to residential school, being abused, neglected, stripped of my culture, family, and language, then seeing a new school built years later on that same site. A school that my own children would end up attending. It would be painful. But in their own way, the chiefs who decided to create Pelican were doing it as an act of colonial defiance, taking a place that once brought so much pain and turning it into something good. At least that's how I see it. And I know I'm not alone.
That's kind of the way I understood it as well. It was just like taking back what was taken previously.
This is Darren Head, the current principal of Pelican.
And you'll have to talk to people who, you know, the survivors about this, but my hope is that this school being here run by a First Nation organization is a part of that healing journey as well, that taking control. And I hope that's the way survivors see it as well. Mm-hmm. My late father-in-law actually attended this school when it was a residential school. Mm-hmm. And you know, he talked a bit about it. There weren't a lot of happy memories mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. But he was involved. He was an elder for NNAC when the school was built. Mm-hmm. And having those conversations, that's how he interpreted it. It's just taking back what was taken previously, mm-hmm. and that healing, helping with that healing. So mm-hmm. That's how I want to see it as well.
When I went to visit the school myself to collect interviews for this podcast, I was lucky to spend a lot of time with the students. For one of the weeks, I was a chaperone on a school incentive trip up to Sandy Lake First Nation. It was a 12-hour drive from Sulakout on the ice road, which was just slightly terrifying to drive at first. As I got the hang of it, I began to chat with the three girls in my truck, wanting to know about their lives and their families as we tore through the ice and snow. I had one conversation with the girls about how they feel about Pelican. The resounding answer was the one I expected least, that the school's grounds were haunted and that they regularly see ghosts on the property.
I'm just here for my education, and like, I just ignore it like I usually would, because that's been happening. Like, I've been getting paranormal experiences, so like, I'm kind of used to it anyways. And like, whenever I see like a black figure at the corner of my eye, I just like kind of dust it off, and it's just like, I'm used to it, I know what it is.
When the girls first told me about their paranormal sightings, I admit I brushed it off as a teenage penchant for drama. But their reasoning made me think twice. Of course, this used to be a residential school.
Yeah, because like, they threw kids in the water, the lake that's just down there, and they buried kids down the thing. So that's probably why like, so many people had like bad, scary experiences here.
I definitely don't know if the Anglican priests who ran the old residential school actually threw bodies of children into the lake. But honestly, knowing what I know about residential schools, I wouldn't be surprised if that were true. What I do know is that the same abuse, the same neglect, and the same shame known at all other Canadian residential schools was also known at this one. I only had to do a cursory Google search to learn about Garnet Anjikneb, who recalled his experiences at the school in an online documentary.
And every once in a while, you could see this particular man lying in bed with a boy. And that happened time and time again. You just were in bed there thinking, I hope he doesn't pick on me tonight.
It's a complicated place, this school, this land. The past breathes through it, as ghosts or as memory. But what I see from the educators that work here is a genuine desire for change. These are people who are just trying to do right by the students, despite the chronic lack of government funding, skyrocketing suicide and addiction rates in the north, and the lack of resources and support services needed for the students to even be on par with the average Canadian student. Fact. According to Indigenous Services Canada, only 44% of Indigenous people on reserve have graduated high school, compared to the 88% of the rest of Canada. According to Indigenous Services Minister Mark Miller, funding for schools like Pelican is a jurisdictional triangle, and they often get caught in the middle of provincial and federal funding delays and confusion. These facts and numbers aren't random. They're a result of historic and ongoing systemic prejudice against Indigenous youth. The staff at Pelican know this. They're aware of the numbers and the stats, but all they have is what they've been given, and it's not much. Even with all that Pelican wants to accomplish, for all the good it's doing, maybe it's not enough.
Well, because it's just not the best option. This isn't, in my opinion, the answer or the solution, right? Like, if ultimately I had my way, I would be worked out of a job, because all of a sudden there wouldn't be a high school that students have to leave their communities to attend. There's like more to this question than I feel like I can even answer, because ideally, I want kids to be with their families. Ideally, we'd have healthy families and healthy parents and healthy communities, right? And that, I know that's not the way it is. So is the answer coming off the reserve for high school? Is this the answer? Is Pelican Falls, like, the answer to the best that we can be as a people and for our people? I don't think so, but I don't know what the solution is. Mm-hmm. So yes, I do believe you're right. This is a very powerful act of defiance, if you like, defiance or act of, I guess, acknowledging something bad that happened in the past, and now we can run a school ourselves. Yeah, that's great. But I'm still not satisfied that this is the best way or that this is how it should be. I don't know what the answer is, but mm-hmm. I still feel, I'm left like hungry and longing still for our people, that this still is not the best, not the ultimate, not what we deserve and whatever. So, yeah.
The students are not just missing out on, you know, family occasions, family events, but they're missing out on opportunities to be out on their own traditional territory. So maybe they're missing their fall goose hunt. Maybe they're missing their spring goose hunt. Maybe they're missing rabbit snaring. Maybe they're missing setting fish nets in the winter. And where schools try their best to offer these services, it's still not on that young person's traditional territory. And when we talk about resiliency amongst our young people and how they're going to overcome intergenerational trauma, we know that that connection back to their land, back to the language of their land, is key to their resiliency.
During all the conversations I had at Pelican, I began to recognize a common theme: the importance of home and how our connections to our traditional territories as Indigenous people truly defines how we grow into adulthood. So what are some possible alternatives to sending these students so far away from their homes, their land, their traditional territories? Karen Daneman is a longtime family friend, and I consider her to be my elder, though she self-describes herself as a helper. She has a dream for the future of all Indigenous kids and what their education could someday look like.
One of the things that I was working on before was I wanted a school in the bush. So I think that I would like to see a part of the education take place on the land, and not just like for an hour at a time, but for long stretches of time where they can learn to actually connect to the land. The land stores the knowledge. And when I say students, I'm not just talking about high school students, but also kindergarten students. Mm. So like anything in between and beyond. And
While there are other education alternatives to consider one day, for now, Pelican is the answer, however imperfect it may be. And to make it clear, I'm in no way inferring any criticism of Pelican staff. After spending time there, I know the staff are the heart of the place, often extending themselves much more than the average educator, taking on multiple roles of driver, cook, shoulder to cry on, just to name a few. And my impression is that they do this willingly, with no hesitation or questions asked, because they know where their students are coming from, that they've been told all their lives that they deserve less than the average Canadian kid.
They don't come in expecting anything, quite honestly, because Canada really hasn't stepped up and provided and met the obligations that we have for our communities in the North. I've worked in Indigenous education my whole teaching career since 1989. Mm-hmm. And while in recent years, last couple of years, some steps in the right direction have been made, we've been so far behind for so long that we've got a long ways to go. And, you got historically systemic neglect of First Nations education has been going on for generations. You think about it every day, that if I was a principal of a public school, I'd have these options that I know I don't. And you see it every single day, you feel it every single day. But you walk out of this office door and you see these kids and you go, that's why I'm still here. This is why this is the place for me. It feels like this is what I need to be doing, right? So yeah, you're frustrated every single day, and I don't think that's ever going to change in my lifetime. Like I said, we've got a long ways to go to deal with the inequities that have been going on for generations. And so but you walk into that foyer and you see a kid or a couple of kids and you just talk for 2 minutes, 2 seconds, and you know why you're here. Mm-hmm. And you know why you keep coming back. I just want them to be happy. I give them the same message as, you know, my dream is to hand you that diploma because I want to see you live a good, healthy, happy life. That's my goal for you. Mm-hmm. This piece of diploma is not going to guarantee it, but it's one step to that healthy, happy life that you deserve. All the challenges, all the things that we end up having to do that are over and above because our students who they are, right? Because the government has neglected them for so long in terms of educational equality and all of those challenges. But those challenges are also what makes it rewarding for us, right? Because you see those smiles, right? You hear that laughter, and it's uplifting, right? And it's that's what they deserve. These, you know, as adults, we all deserve to be happy and smile and laugh, and that's all I want for them, right? Just live a good, healthy, happy life.
Last question. What do you hope for your future?
I hope to become successful and to support my family and make change in this world, because the way things are going right now, I say we don't have much time with all this climate change and people going against each other. I want to bring everyone close together and make it way more different for the next generation.
In the next episode, we take a look at what you might call Pelican's sister school, Dennis Franklin Cromartie High School in the city of Thunder Bay, which is a 4-hour drive east of Sulakout.
The audio clip of Garnett Anjkinab used in this episode is from Ashley Wright's 2012 documentary, Garnett Full Circle.